Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, April 21st. I'm Ray Graff. Today we welcome two astronomers into the studio. Bob Berman is joined by Valerie Rapson of the Dudley Observatory in New York's Capital Region. If you have a question about Mars, comets, gravity, maybe a comet Atlas, which looks like it'll be fizzling before we get to see it, this dynamic duo is ready for an answer. Give us a call, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Again, that number is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is here. Valerie Rapson is here. It's Astronomy on Vox Pop. Your calls right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Two astronomers are on hand today to answer your questions about the final frontier. One of them is the best-known, most widely read astronomers in the world, or certainly one of those. Bob Berman is here. He is the astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac and a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. And Dr. Valerie Rapson is here, chief astronomer at the Dudley Observatory. She earned her PhD in astrophysical science and technology at RIT. Her dissertation focused on the chemical composition and structure of planet-forming disks around nearby young stars. You have a question about the heavens? Call us, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. The number again is 800-348-2551. Valerie Rapson, Bob Berman, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you.
Yes, thanks. Great to be here, even if it's virtual.
Yeah, well, you know, it's always better to have you both in the studio, but we do what we can in this lockdown. One of the things that I think is, you know, if there's a silver lining in this whole situation where a lot of people are home and it's a scary time and an unsettled time and not all that pleasant at all, even if you are healthy. One of the things is you get a chance to perhaps reconnect with some of the simpler things. And one of the things I've been doing with my family is sitting out and looking at the stars. And aside from the Starlink satellites, it has been fabulous. But, you know, I was really excited. I emailed you both a couple weeks ago. I said, okay, this is all over the popular press. Comet Atlas is going to be a giant. Bob Berman typically was, let's just wait. And, of course, the whole thing crumbled. Valerie, did you guys see this coming?
I think we did. I mean, we like to get excited about these comets, but unfortunately, most of them do end up falling apart before they get really bright in the sky. But we were able to take some pictures of it with the telescope at Siena, so that was pretty cool.
It was green, right, Bob?
Green indeed, thanks to diatomic carbon and cyanogen. But comets are heartbreakers. They break your heart over and over. And how many times, it's like Charlie Brown and Lucy, how many times you have to have that football pulled away from you? I'm showing my age with this. Do people even read comic strips anymore? Probably not.
Well,
but how many times with Kohoutek and ISON and over again before you start to learn, no, it could get spectacular. We had that with a view, Yakutake and Hale Bopp in the mid-90s. But by and large, like Valerie says, no, probably not. And sure enough, this one's just tearing itself apart.
And so what happens is it goes around the sun and the sun, the solar wind pulls it apart, or what happens there?
Yes, the sun's gravity. That's what happened with ISON. That was supposed to be the comet of the century. We monetize that. You know, it's great to monetize things like corona if you can, or comets if you can. And my daughter's tour company, well, boy, there was 110 people that signed up to come to Chile to see it.
Yeah.
Fortunately, there were lots of other great things to see, too. But just then, the same thing happened as happened with Atlas. Gets too close to the sun, falls apart, and it fizzles out.
It's too soon to be talking about monetizing corona, but let's move on. Now, Valerie, you said there's another comet possibly on the horizon here.
Yeah, so there's Comet Swan, which is currently only visible in the southern hemisphere, unfortunately, but that one is headed towards us, and it's supposed to pass the Earth on a close approach around mid-May. They're thinking May 12th that'll be closest to us. So if this one holds, people in the southern hemisphere might be able to take a look at it in early to mid-May.
The number here, by the way, is 800-348-2551. We have astronomer Bob Berman and astronomer Valerie Rapson here with us. I was listening on the roundtable, I think it was the roundtable, maybe it was midday, and the Stardate, they were talking about the comet show that's going on, I mean the meteor shower that's going on right now, LIRID. And one thing that caught my ear, even though I was doing something else, they said last year there was also another small meteor shower that went on at the same time that was connected to a comet that we have never seen in historical times, and it's quite possibly enormous. Do either of you know anything about that?
I don't know about that one, but many of our best meteor showers are associated with comets, even like the most famous Comet Halley. The Great Perseid Shower every summer is came off the comet Swift Tuttle, discovered by those Civil War astronomers, Horace Swift, and what was the other guy's first name? Doesn't matter. So the comets are associated with meteor showers. That one, by the way, is the most dangerous object to human life that's ever been discovered in the whole universe.
Which one?
A comet Swift Tuttle, because number one, it's huge. Number two, it orbits in the opposite direction from us, so it has a super high speed relative to us. And third, it comes very close every 120 years or so. So sooner or later, that one could give us a dinosaur ending type extinction. So yeah, you're right. Comets are nothing to sneeze at.
Well, what really caught my ear about this particular news item, I think it was on Stardate, was that this little shower that was with the LIRIDs last year, which we won't see again, I guess, until maybe 2027. They postulate that because these meteors are going so fast that the comet involved, the parent comet, is enormous. Now, why would the size of a comet have to do with the speed of the meteors?
Oh, it doesn't. No, you're right to be skeptical. The speed of the meteor really matches the size of the comet in the orbit, and that, in turn, has to do with whether the comet is orbiting in the same direction that almost everything else does. We've pretty much got a one-way solar system, in that if you're north of the solar system, everything's orbiting counterclockwise. If you're a planet, almost all of the moons of all the planets, the rotation of the sun, it's a one-way stream, and asteroids obey that, but comets don't. Comets are random, so almost half of them come in either vertically, in other words, they dive down from the north or come up from the south, or orbit backwards, and those are the ones that can deliver those screaming high speeds. We move at almost 19 miles per second as we orbit the sun, so if an object's orbiting in the opposite direction, it can have a closing speed to us of double that, almost 40 miles per second.
How big was the comet, Valerie, that hit in Siberia in 1908?
Oh, I don't think that one actually struck. I believe that one exploded, and that's what leveled the forest. I don't recall exactly how big it is, but my guess would be maybe tens of meters wide. Not humongous, not global devastation, but definitely big enough to cause an issue, for sure.
Yeah, she's exactly right. That was an airburst. That was on June 30th of that year, and it was an airburst just like that one recently over Chelyabinsk, again in Siberia. That also was an airburst, but still managed to give off the same explosive power as an atomic bomb.
Let's take a break here. Valerie Rapson is here. Bob Berman, it's Astronomy Today on Vox Pop. The number is 800-348-2551, and we'll get to your calls in a moment. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here, and it's the Astronomy Show today. Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman are joining us once again, this time via telephone. 800-348-2551 is the number. If you want to join us via telephone, let's go to Mark in Salem. Mark, you're on.
Hi, Ray. Of course, you know that I was associated with the Dudley Observatories, so my question is directed towards Dr. Valerie. What's her last name?
Rapson.
Rapson, thank you.
Yeah.
Is she familiar with the history of the Dudley Observatory written by Benjamin Boss? And there was a situation, it was almost comical, about the naming of the asteroid. She named it Pandora because of all the confrontation around everything that was happening in Albany. Even President Lincoln got involved. Huh. Does she know anything about that?
I don't know. Valerie? Yeah.
Yeah, so when I first got my job at the Dudley Observatory, they literally handed me the two books that you're referencing, the history of the Dudley Observatory, so I had to read through them. But I don't recall the story about the Pandora asteroid, so that's really interesting. I'll have to look into it more.
Do you mind if I tell you?
Well, if you got a minute, yeah.
What happened was that the directors of the observatory, and he was from Cincinnati, where he set up the first observatory, a 12-inch or 13-inch refractor, and then he was attracted to Albany, and people were coming onto the property and disturbing the astronomers, and everybody said, well, you know, you can't do this. And they locked the gate, and this is when the observatory is located on the north side of I-90. And during that time period, they discovered this asteroid, which was in the asteroid belt, and Blandina Dudley, who was the one that put up the money for building the observatory, at least started it, she was asked to name the comet. And because of all the frustration and consternation, she decided to call it Pandora.
That
was the story of it.
That's great. That's great. I didn't know that. Thanks for the story.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Valerie Rapson is here, and Bob Berman. It's Astronomy.
And Ray, this is Bob, of course. And could I ask you a question?
I suppose.
Well, you mentioned at the start about that we're locked in our houses and it's a great time to look up at the sky and become acquainted with astronomy. And something is happening right now that is so spectacular that since you say you and your kids are looking at the sky, I'll just ask you as a stand-in for Joe Average in our country, when you look up these evenings at dinner time, what grabs your attention?
Well, we don't go out at dinner time. We're generally eating. But, I see your point. The planets are lining up, right?
It is Venus at its very best.
Yeah, well, Venus is very bright into the evening. We were out having a bonfire the other night. It set, 9:30 or 10, it was getting low, 10, 11 o'clock at night, something like that?
It's so high and it's up so long and it's so bright that it is only every 8 years do we have the very best apparition of the evening star. The evening star is Venus, especially in this case. And it's so spectacular, and it's only for now. In just a few weeks, it's going to start dropping into the twilight and not being as high, and it'll be gone in another month or so, a little more than a month. So just for people who do look up in the sky, I know a lot of people are wondering, what is that? Some people think it's a UFO. Some say it can't be a natural object. It's just too darn bright. So just those first couple of hours after nightfall, you don't even have to ask which direction. It's towards the west, the direction of sunset, but just look around the sky. There is nothing, especially these moonless nights, there is nothing that is remotely as bright as Venus. It's just dazzling. The closest planet in the universe to us, the shiniest object in the solar system, and very strange in its own right. And it's when it gets at its very best, it's not common, but it's happening right now.
You know, and as we watched it on Saturday night, I think it was Friday or Saturday night, it was a beautiful, clear, dark night. And as we watched Venus, a little lower in the sky, we watched Starlink after Starlink after Starlink satellite go. How many of those are up there now, and how irritated are astronomers by this?
Very. Extremely.
Yeah.
Extremely. And it's only the beginning, because other companies have also announced that they're going to launch their own constellations, that's what they call them, of satellites. And there will be more satellites before too long than there are stars in the night sky. So, of course, when we try to take astro photos and image objects and do research, now we're getting streaks through them because there are just so many. And it's a shame that astronomers or even nature lovers or even the public wasn't asked, do you mind if the night sky is despoiled forever, is now filled with satellites moving across? Is this all right with you? Because it sure isn't.
Valerie.
Yeah, so they're actually supposed to launch some more on Wednesday. I believe everything is still going as planned. Another 60 are supposed to be launched on a Falcon 9 rocket. So we should be up to about 420 orbiting around the Earth. And they're really just a pain in the neck. And as Bob said, it's only going to get worse with more satellites. And they recently tried to, like, paint them a darker color to stop them from reflecting the sunlight. And it's really just not working very well. So we'll have to wait and see how this goes, but not looking good for us.
There's only one bit of consolation, and I guess since everybody's bummed about COVID, we shouldn't just have a unrelentingly gloomy anything here. So there is one little bit of consolation, and that is that satellites are preferentially seen during the first hour and a half after nightfall, that is around twilight and when twilight is deepening, and then again before dawn. But they cannot be seen in the middle of the night. So 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12, 1, 2, we should have a break from them, especially during the cold half of the year when that break will even extend a little bit more and they'll be even less visible. So it won't be all night long. It'll just be part of the night.
Bob Berman is here and Valerie Rapson. It's Astronomy Today, 800-348-2551. Mary is in Hudson. Mary, you're on.
Hi. Good afternoon, everyone.
Hi.
Is it true that when they were doing experiments to find out what is the substance in the midst of a nucleus, which is, you know, the center of an atom, in order to discover what that is, that they found that it's actually nothing substantial, that it's actually, to the best of their ability, to describe data or information, such that since atoms, everything in our reality here on Earth and certainly in the heavens appears substantial, it's all made up of atoms, such that nothing is actually substantial, which makes everything that we see here and certainly in the heavens even more remarkable and miraculous. Am I way off?
It's a little bit
that
off.
Way.
It's a little bit off.
Well,
in that.
That sounds like me, so that's good.
That's all right. You know what?
Go ahead.
Now you've started them, Mary, so now we're off to the races.
So we can each have a crack at this. What I would say is that at the heart of every atom, of course, there's a there are protons, and in most atoms, except for hydrogen, neutrons, each of which weigh, it's not nothing, each weighs 1,836 times more than an electron. So that is a bit of mass. Ultimately, mass and energy are the same. So if you prefer to think of it as energy, it's still an intense concentration of energy. So that's not nothing.
Right.
And so this mass slash energy is at the heart of it, and it has effects. As we know, it can bend starlight. It can guide planets as they go around the sun. And it's all from atoms, and most of the mass in atoms are in these are in their nuclei. So it's far from nothing. Of course, if you want to then leap into, well, is this all part of consciousness? And does human consciousness and observations lie at the heart of everything? I mean, you can get increasingly metaphysical or far out with all of this. But if you're sticking with physics, it wouldn't be accurate to say that there's nothing or that there's nothingness or insubstantiality in the heart of atoms. What would you say,
Valerie? Well, I said there's data. It's data and information. I'm not saying it's nothing, but yeah, okay, go ahead.
Right, yeah, so Bob is right. There's definitely physical stuff that makes up the atoms, that makes up our universe. I think what you're trying to get at, though, is when they did this gold foil experiment, they realized that the atom is mostly empty space. So when they realized the nucleus was very small, the electrons were very far out, that's what we see with the atoms, and that's what we also see with physical outer space. There's a very little amount of stuff between us and other stars and galaxies, but in general, it's just a vacuum. It's mostly empty space. So I think that's right. The connection you're trying to make, but there's definitely still stuff out there for sure.
All right.
Yeah, if you put the atomic nucleus at the 50-yard line of a football stadium, and let it be represented by a fly sitting at the middle of the football stadium, the electrons would be all the way out in the seats as weighing almost 2,000 times less than a fly, each electron. So imagine a fly in the middle of a football stadium, and it's all empty until you get to the seats of the stadium, and then there you have something 2,000 times lighter than even the fly that's orbiting it. So darn right. The atoms are quite empty. I may have mistook or misheard the caller talk about the nucleus of an atom, so that's what I was addressing.
Gotcha. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson here, and let's go to Bob in Broad Auburn. Bob.
Thank you, and good day to Dr. Berman and Valerie Rapson, by the way, whom I've had an opportunity to meet at the Physics Colloquium at Union College on Thursday. To give you a heads up, my focus is on the graviton. Early on, we evolved from the Newtonian physics to the theories of Planck and Einstein to relativistic physics. That is a grand scale physics. We then got to a theory of the small in quantum mechanics, which experimentally demonstrates the accuracy or the correctness of quantum theory, notwithstanding that attempts to unify them have been futile, with theories of wave theory by Molinaro, et cetera, as the proper approach. My question is, we tend to think in terms of, or we learn to think in terms of particle-wave duality. And how does one confront the graviton on a grand scale? And I once asked Lisa Reynolds, a theoretical physicist, is the graviton for real? And she said, well, that depends on what you mean for real. How do you approach the graviton? What does it mean to you?
Yeah, that's a tricky one because, you know, we haven't really developed a true understanding of the graviton, if the graviton exists. I mean, it's supposed to be this theoretical particle that helps cause gravity, and we have to balance that with, of course, Einstein's ideas of gravity, the curvature of space-time, and in the sense that it's not really a physical particle that's pulling on things, it's actually just a natural curvature of space-time. So most of quantum theory, the graviton and all that, is way above my head. But, you know, I think we're still looking and we're trying to understand that if the graviton exists, is it a wave and a particle in the same sense that light is, or is it something completely different? I don't know. Bob, do you know more about the graviton?
Well, I'll say this about that. The whole idea is that there is such a thing as force-carrying particles. Now, most of us know that there are four fundamental forces. Gravity is one of them. Electromagnetism is another one. That's what gives us our magnetic effects, like our power windows in our cars. It gives us light. But here's the thing. Light, we think of it as little particles, photons, that have no rest mass, photons. But what we've realized is that photons, bits of light, are actually just the force-carrying particle for the electromagnetic force. In other words, this is what electromagnetic the force uses to go from one place to another. So let's say in the heart of stars, far away in the Andromeda galaxy, this force is generated, electromagnetism. Well, it travels outward by bits of light. and it's tireless. It'll travel across the universe. Then when it hits your eyes or goes through my telescope and hits us, it delivers that force like a butler. It just delivers it to the retinas of our eyes, and that stimulates a bit of electricity, and our brains in response see all the nice colors and the shapes and everything we see around us in the world. But it all starts from that bit of that photon delivering the electromagnetic force. So with gravity, we say to ourselves, well, what is the force carrying particle for gravity? What carries it from one place to another? And what was postulated is that it's a hypothetical force called the graviton.
Okay.
That gravitons would be little things that carry gravity from one place to another. And the problem, as Valerie just eloquently put forth, is that they've never been found. And experiments trying to find them have not found the graviton. So while it makes sense that gravity should be carried just as electromagnetism is, and the strong and the weak forces are, where is the force-carrying particle for gravity? That would be the graviton. And so it still remains an unsolved issue.
It's Astronomy Today on Vox Pop. Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson are here. Paul in Rivington. Paul, you're on.
Hello, everybody. The year was 1947 or 1948. The location was Los Angeles, California. My buddy and I, we were about 12 or 13 years of age, and we happened to look up at the sky. The whole observable sky everywhere was covered with little shooting stars.
Mm.
It just kept on going. And the next morning, we looked in the local newspaper, and they mentioned the name Giacobini Zinner. And I'm wondering if you've heard of that. And if that will ever return again to our sky.
Well, you got really lucky. That's called a meteor storm. When you see, and there have been storms that have delivered as many as 50 meteors per second, not per minute or per hour, 50 shooting stars a second. And it all started really with the famous Leonid storms of 1799, followed by a beautiful display in 1833, and then in 1866. See what we're getting at? It has a 33-year periodicity that matches the comet. So we expected a wonderful storm. Imagine that, hundreds, perhaps as many as 60 or 100 shooting stars per second. But it failed to repeat in 1899 or in 1933, and astronomers said, well, this comet's been perturbed. The meteor shower has been ruined by the presence of large planets like Jupiter. It's finished. So nobody was expecting it. When two of my former students told me, one was on guard as in the Army in the southwestern United States. The other was on a train in Texas on the morning, the early hours of November 18th, 1966, when, darn it, there it was again. She said that the meteors were just streaming across as if there was a hole drilled in the sky and sparks were leaking from that hole, because during a storm like the one you saw, sir, all the meteors, as you can confirm, all seem to come from one spot. They all radiate from one spot in the sky, which makes it even stranger. And so she was sure it was the end of the world. This woman, Victoria Drowns, I still remember her name, maybe because it's so unusual, told me that everyone around her in the compartment was asleep. And she wondered, well, what are you supposed to do if it's the end of the world? Which she was sure it was, because what else could it be? She said, what's the etiquette? Do you wake people up for Armageddon, or do you let them sleep through it? And she just watched these sleepy people. Then finally the conductor came down the aisle, and the two of them together looked out the window and watched this until dawn erased the scene. So, of course, we all are aching to see a true meteor storm. And the best that came was the one on the early hours of November 18, 2001, when we had a beautiful display. Finally, we had a beautiful display of these same Leonid meteors. And I hope some of our listeners were up that morning watching the sky from 2 a.m. till dawn, right here from our region, and saw that wasn't one of those 60 or 100 per second. We were getting 5 to 7 per minute. They were all bright. They were all green. They all left lingering trails, they're called trains, behind them, and that was the best meteor shower of our lives. So, sir, that the one that you saw, I salute you for your good fortune to have seen it.
Valerie, you ever see something like that?
No, I have not seen anything like that, but I am dying to. And unfortunately, I wasn't old enough to care enough in 2001 to go outside and and go check it out. But, you know, coming up in the future, I'll be the first one out there as soon as something like this happens.
All right, let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Dr. Valerie Rapson of the Dudley Observatory is here, and astronomer and author Bob Berman as well. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. It's Astronomy Today with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. We'll handle a couple of emails here, gang, and then we'll get back to the phones. Valerie, we'll throw this one to you. This one is from Al. Al writes, the images of the Earth from the Apollo missions all appeared as a globe would appear sitting on a living room table, right side up. Should there not be a right side up one people see in a spacecraft, or shouldn't there not be a right side up for people in spacecraft? If the spacecraft was to invert itself, the Earth would then appear to our eyes upside down in a photograph. But wouldn't the astronauts never feel upside down? Why was the Earth always right side up in the photographs?
Right.
All right. Well,
that's a great, great question. So our observations from the moon's perspective, the Earth is naturally going to be right side up just from the fact that, you know, we're looking at it from the moon. But yeah, if you're taking the photograph and you're technically upside down compared to what we call north on the Earth, you could definitely have an image that's upside down. But I think a lot of those images were just flipped because it's natural for us to observe the Earth in a certain way.
Right.
So my guess is that many of the photos, if they were originally technically upside down, they probably just were flipped to show us, make us feel more comfortable when we were looking at them. But yeah, astronauts don't really have a sense of upside down and right side up once they've left the Earth.
And really, I mean, I remember a world map that I think I had for the kids that was everything was upside down, just to give everybody a different perspective. This one is from Rich. I'll throw this one to you first, Bob. Rich writes, I have used a planisphere since I was a kid long ago, and something has always puzzled me. Why is the view of the sky on the planisphere an oval? If I look up at the sky, I see a hemisphere, not an oval. This has always made it a little difficult to use to translate this distorted sky view to my actual view. Any thoughts on this?
Well, yeah, anytime you're trying to translate a curved surface to a flat plane, whether it's an Earth globe or a portrayal of the sky's hemisphere, there's going to be distortion. We see this with Mercator projections that make Greenland look bigger than Africa, when in truth the opposite is the truth.
Right.
And so in the planisphere, which is one of those revolving dials that are supposedly going to show you the hemisphere of the sky on a little flat plane, there has to be distortion. So the way it's done produces that curved horizon. And there's a second reason for it also, and that is much has to be hidden because as you wheel it around, you're only going to see part of the sky at a time, because as you match up the date and the year and the time of night, new things will appear and old things will have set. So you need part of the hemisphere, the cardboard, to hide the places where things that are not visible are lurking until you turn the wheel. And so that curved configuration allows more of the part of the sky that you're not seeing to be hidden from view and to come into view as you wheel it around.
All right, this is from a Val in Troy, so we'll throw it to our Val. Val writes, will Hale-Bopp be back? It was so wonderful to see after not having bothered to stay up for the disappointing, I am told, Halley's Comet.
Yeah, so I'm looking up Hale-Bopp right now. It's the beauty of being at home in front of a computer. To remind myself of exactly when it's going to come back, right? So this is the very long period one. It's predicted to come back not until the year 4380.
Oh, okay.
So we've got a long ways to go. Yeah, it's got a 2,500-year period. So those people that are around a couple thousand years from now could potentially see Hale Bopp.
All right, but
wait a second, Valerie. In my head, I'm not in front of the computer, but as Ray knows, I'm sort of a Rain Man type.
Yes, well, that's certainly true.
Idiot, almost savant, except without the savant part.
No.
The figure I have in my head is 24,000 years. So could you double-check that and see if I'm remembering it wrong?
Well, I am trusting Google and Wikipedia here. It says 2,500 years coming back in the year 4.
Either way, it's unlikely our writer, Val, will be alive at the time. I'm sorry to say, Val.
Right.
But you know, none of us
will be, unfortunately.
But maybe Comet Swan will be better than we think, right?
Right, that's true.
I hope so. We're sort of overdue. We get what's called a great comet, and that adjective is not just, hey, yeah, that's great, that's swell. It's actually the technical term for a comet that's bright enough to be seen over city light-polluted skies.
Yeah.
So we get one every 15 to 20 years on average. So we got lucky and had two in the mid-90s with Yakutake and Hale Bopp. And before that, we had Comet West in March of 1976. That was exactly 20 years earlier. And so now more than 20 years have passed, and it doesn't work that way, of course, but we're really overdue for a bright comet. So I hope this one pans out.
Let's go back to the phones at 800-348-2551. Barbara in Rensselaer. Barbara.
I have three parts to my question. Is the universe expanding at a constant rate? And if it is, what is the rate? And what is the expansion of the universe doing to the distance between the Earth and the Sun? Thank you.
Okay. Hang in there,
Barbara. Can I take the first part of it?
All right.
Sure.
Go ahead, Bob.
Sure.
It is not a constant rate, but before we get to that, it is over reasonable distances, it's constant, and it's very easy to remember. It's 14 miles per second faster. Everything expands away from you 14 miles per second for every million light years further that you're looking. So for every million light years, things are racing away at another 14 miles per second. Some say 13 miles per second, but that's the expansion rate called the Hubble flow. And the big bombshell news from 1998 is that, no, it's increasing its rate, as if there's a giant explosion going on that's making it expand faster and faster over time. Let me hand this over to Valerie at this point,
all right,
so I don't hog everything here.
No, it's all good.
Go ahead, Barbara.
With respect to what Bob just said, does that mean that there's a constant acceleration then?
Yeah, so the expansion rate of the universe is accelerating. So as Bob said, for every second that we literally sit here and talk, the universe is expanding at a faster and faster rate. And the key thing to remember about expansion is it's the space between the galaxies and the universe that's expanding. A lot of people have the misconception that our solar system is stretching and that the Earth is moving away from the Sun. No, none of that is happening. It's literally on a much grander scale. Gravity holds everything together in our galaxy and our solar system, and it's the space between the galaxies that's growing larger at this faster and faster rate.
Thank you very much.
Was that the whole question, Barbara?
Yes,
Okay, great. Well, thank you for calling. And now over to Kathy in Saratoga Springs. Kathy.
Well, again, my question was, I'd like to purchase a telescope, and, you know, I just wanted to know what you would recommend for a beginner at under $500 and enjoy it.
No, don't get anything under $500. You'll get junk.
Well, what if that's all you have, Bob?
Oh. I agree. I think you can get a scope.
What do you say, Valerie?
Here's the thing. If you get a telescope and either the tripod is wobbly or it'll show some objects, but there's a whole universe of things that you're aching to see that can't be seen. For example, arguably the best deep space objects are globular clusters. Those are cities of suns where a million stars are packed into a ball, and you can actually see the separate stars that make up these clusters. Well, they cannot be seen in telescopes that have a lens or a mirror smaller than about 6 inches in diameter. In fact, one of the discoverers of several of them, Charles Messier, late in the 18th century, wrote in his notes, it always cracks me up when I see it, he wrote, This is a perfectly round nebula that I am sure contains no star. In other words, he was seeing this as a ball, a fuzzy ball. And that's how you'll see it, too, if your telescope has a lens or mirror less than about 6 inches. So let's say you buy a cheaper telescope as a 3-inch telescope, because their telescopes are always measured by the diameter of their lens or mirror. And, yeah, you can see craters on the moon. You can see something with the rings of Saturn. And if that's enough for you, if your interest is sort of part-time
well,
interest.
No, I would like to, I mean, so what would you recommend within a reasonable?
All right, well, Valerie says that she disagrees that you can get a good telescope for under $500. Yeah. So, Valerie, go ahead.
So what we purchase for our students that we train with telescopes is called a Dobsonian-style telescope. It's a long tube with a wooden base that sits on the ground. You don't need a tripod for it. And for about $300, you can get a really nice 6-inch telescope. That's what we buy. And, you know, you're not going to see the deepest depths of the universe, but you'll definitely be able to see the planets and even some galaxies with it. So if you check out our website, dudleyobservatory.org, there's information there. And you can also shoot me an email. I can send you some specific suggestions if you like.
Oh, that's great. What is your email address, Valerie?
Yeah, you people can use info@dudleyobservatory.org, and those get forwarded right to me.
You got that, Kathy?
Info. No, info.
@dudleyobservatory.org.
Dudley.
Yep.
Okay. But there's one more thing you should know, caller. Kathy.
Okay. Go ahead.
And that is that as you're...
Well, I mean, I'm willing to spend more. What would you recommend that would be...
Okay, well,
you know,
consider this. As you're watching the sky, everything in the sky is moving, of course, because Earth is rotating. We all know that the moon changes its position just visibly over the course of not very much time. And when you're using a telescope that's magnifying the image, the actual thing you're looking at, whether it's Jupiter or Saturn or double stars or anything, is actually going to disappear from your field of view in a minute or two. So you've found the object you're looking for. You're looking through a finder. Hopefully it's a decent finder. You've got the object centered. You're starting to look. You call over a friend, hey, have a look. And by the time they look, it's not there. They say, I don't see it. What are you talking about? Because the object has drifted out of the field. So better telescopes have motors that automatically track the object in the sky. And it's not even difficult technology. The better ones, you just plop it down and face the axis towards the north, and now it'll track. So if you didn't have it, boy, you might say after half a year or a year of having your telescope, gee, I wish I had one that had a clock drive.
Okay.
They're only an extra few $100. And so the bottom line is, if you have a serious and continued interest or are with people who might, I'd say buy a good pair of binoculars, get to know the sky with binoculars, save the money, and get a telescope that'll give you a lifetime of pleasure.
Right.
But Valerie's not wrong. If you got a $300 telescope, you'd certainly get a lot of pleasure from it. The craters on the moon will be spectacular for the rings of Saturn.
Kathy, thank you for that call. Let's quick. We only have a couple of minutes here. Let's go over to Joe in Albany. Joe, you're on.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I had a question about supernovas. I was wondering if there was a way that we can predict them, if science can predict them, and if so, is there sort of a calendar for which, say, novice can look up at?
Valerie.
I wish we could predict them, because I'd be outside every night looking at them if we could. But unfortunately, that's really tricky to do, because stars explode. They end their lives, and there's, like, you know, 10,000, 20,000-year buffer when a star could actually explode. That's why we don't know exactly when Betelgeuse is going to explode. So, unfortunately, it's not that easy to predict them.
And, Bob, Betelgeuse, by the way, has sort of rebrightened, right?
It has. Have you noticed it, Ray?
No, I may have, but not by name.
Oh, it's so exciting. Yes, those who can recognize Orion, which these nights is just over the sunset point.
Oh, yeah.
Not too far from brilliant Venus, the brightest thing in the sky. Yeah, that leftmost shoulder star, which had faded to match the rightmost shoulder star, Bellatrix, it's come back.
Yeah.
Our beloved star Betelgeuse, or you could say Betelgeuse if you wish, has come back. It's back to full brightness now, as of last night when I looked.
And that means what exactly in 1 minute that we have left?
Whatever was causing it, and nobody's quite sure, but it's as likely as not something blocking Betelgeuse rather than an intrinsic changing of the star. The star does kind of breathe in and out. It gets bigger and smaller like a balloon inflating and deflating. It does do that. And that may be responsible for some of the variability we see on a multi-year basis. But in this case, the thinking is that it's as likely as not something in space that's been an extended material that's been blocking it and now has uncovered it again. So it's back.
Hey, let me ask you both, and I'll ask Val first here. We only have about 30 seconds, but, you know, we sit out and look at the stars a lot. And one of the things that I have noticed, because there are less airplanes going all day, the skies seem clearer even in suburbia. Does that hold for you, Valerie?
Yeah, definitely. And this is a good time of year to look out. In the winter and early spring sky, the skies are a little bit more calm and clear. There's less water vapor. So it's definitely going to be a good time to start looking up at night.
All right, Bob, we have 15 seconds.
Yeah, I'd say, the only thing coming from planes these days are those chemtrails as they're trying to mind control the people down below. So
really?
That's the only thing you can actually see coming out the back of the plane.
So at this point in the show, now you're going to start that. Okay, thanks, Bob. Bob Berman, thank you for being here. Valerie Robson, thank you for being here as well. We're done for today, but these two will be back, and hopefully the next time they're back, they will be in the studio. It's always fun to have them in the studio, but thank you both for being here via telephone. Support comes from Nine Pin Cider Works, Albany. Hard cider made from local apples. Pizza, light fare, and cider for pickup and delivery. 7 days a week for delivery. Call 518-449-9999. NinePinCider.com. Agricultural Stewardship Association. Helping people conserve farmland in the Upper Hudson Valley. We conserve good farmland for good forever. AGStewardship.org. Stavros. Helping people with disabilities to work towards their dreams. Offices in Amherst, Greenfield, and Springfield, Stavros.org for more information. And C&H Architects, working with residential clients throughout the Berkshires and Hudson Valley to create a legacy of sustainable architecture designed for the next 100 years, C&HArchitects.com. Once again, thanks to Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson of Dudley Observatory for being here today. Thank you for listening. Great calls, as always. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Phones answered by Kayleen White. Our producer is Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow at 2 p.m., be with us for an exciting, exhilarating episode of Pets und Vets. Right now, stand by for the book show.